A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of thing that gets under your skin once you notice it. He and Henna took a first aid course before their son was born. He felt prepared. 18 months later, he realized he couldn't confidently perform CPR if his life depended on it. And here's the thing. Research backs him up. CPR skills measurably decay within 3 to 6 months post-training. Meanwhile, he's carrying a phone with a LiDAR scanner and ARKit that could map a room and overlay step-by-step guidance in real time. And yet, no app, no refresher system, nothing persistent exists to bridge that gap.
That's the part that gets me. This isn't about a lack of courses. Mag and David Adam runs them, the Red Cross runs them, hospitals run them. The problem is what happens after the certificate is printed. And the most critical just-in-time knowledge we possess as a species, how to keep a human being alive for the next 3 minutes, is locked inside a 4-hour course you took once and a PDF that looks like it was formatted for a BlackBerry.
Something that should absolutely exist by now, but doesn't, despite the technology being ready and the demand being real. Here's a static image from the Obama administration. Good luck.
Majin David Adams' website has a first aid page. I looked at it. It's static text. No interactivity, no AR, no spaced repetition, just paragraphs on a screen. Majin David Adam runs them. Sometimes United Hatsala volunteers do sessions. 100 to 120 compressions per minute. And the depth matters. At least 2 inches for adults, about 1.5 inches for infants.
The forgetting curve doesn't care how motivated you are.
It really doesn't. The American Heart Association has tracked this, and the numbers are brutal. CPR skill retention drops below 50% within 6 months of training. That's not 6 months of negligence. That's 6 months of normal life where your baby didn't choke and you didn't need to use the skill. By the time you do need it, half of what you learned is gone.
Daniel's experience isn't a personal failure, which I think is worth naming explicitly. He's motivated. He's willing to pay for a validated app. He went actively searching. The system failed him. The system is failing basically everyone who isn't an EMT recertifying on a schedule.
By a year out, many people perform no better than untrained bystanders on key metrics. The American Red Cross First Aid app has some videos, which is better than nothing, but there's no augmented reality, no AI-driven feedback, no way to practice compressions and get told whether your depth and rate are correct. The British Red Cross app has simple animations. Majin David Adam and United Hatsala, the two primary emergency organizations here in Israel, neither one offers a digital refresher tool with any kind of interactive component.
United Hatsala's app is genuinely impressive for what it does. It dispatches volunteers to nearby emergencies. It saved countless lives. But it's not a training tool. It's a response tool. Different category entirely.
But human memory doesn't work on a 2-year cycle. You take the course, you get the card, you're good for 24 months. But the science says you started losing competence before the ink dried on the certificate.
It's compliance theater dressed up as public health.
You could point your phone at a person on the ground and see exactly where to place your hands, how deep to compress, what rhythm to maintain. The technology is production ready. An app that gives real-time guidance in an emergency? That's a legal exposure nightmare for a risk-averse institution.
Which brings us back to Daniel's core question. He's not just asking why the app doesn't exist. He's asking about the community of people who want this to exist and whether anyone anywhere has actually stepped up to build it. Is there a Denmark out there that figured this out? Is there a startup that saw the gap and filled it? Or are we all just waiting for someone to get around to it?
That's exactly where we need to go next, because the answer is more interesting than just, nobody's done it. Some people have. That's what we want to dig into today. Why does this gap exist? What would it actually take to build a persistent, community-driven refresher ecosystem? And who should be doing it? Governments, the private sector, or communities themselves? Let's widen the lens, because Daniel's experience in Israel isn't unique. He ran into a wall here, but the same wall exists in London, in Chicago, in Sydney. I pulled up the digital offerings from the major first aid organizations globally, and the pattern is remarkably consistent. The American Red Cross First Aid app has videos, but they're essentially YouTube embeds inside an app wrapper. Let's ground this in what Daniel actually found when he went looking. Mogan David Adams' first aid page is essentially a digital pamphlet. Text descriptions of procedures, some diagrams, no interactive elements whatsoever. The content is medically sound, but is delivered in exactly the format you'd expect from a website built a decade ago and occasionally updated.
It's not that Israel is behind the curve. The curve itself is flat.
That's worth sitting with for a second, because the instinct is to say, well, Israel's a small country, maybe the market's too niche. But the American Red Cross serves over 300 million people, and their app is essentially a reference manual with some video clips. This isn't a scale problem, it's a design philosophy problem.
The design philosophy being, we've digitized the pamphlet.
If you're maintaining an app or a platform, you have half a decade to prepare for the next revision. The technical challenge is essentially zero. But we're now in a world where your phone can measure the depth of a room, track the motion of your hands in three dimensions, and run machine learning models locally without sending data to a server. The gap between what's possible and what's delivered is wider than it's ever been.
Daniel's specific frustration is that he's not asking for a miracle. He's not saying, why hasn't someone built a holographic emergency room simulator? He just wanted visuals, something that shows rather than tells. And even that low bar, in a country with some of the most sophisticated emergency response infrastructure in the world, wasn't met.
Right, and this is where the Israeli context gets interesting. Magen David Adam is the National Emergency Medical Service. What makes it podcast-worthy is that this isn't some niche edge case. First aid skill decay affects essentially everyone who's ever taken a course. We're talking millions of people walking around with certifications that represent knowledge they no longer possess. And the fix isn't a moonshot. It's an app with spaced repetition and AR overlays.
The fact that it's so achievable is what makes the absence so glaring. If this required some breakthrough in haptic feedback or neural interfaces, fine, we'd wait. But the phone in Daniel's pocket can already do room-scale AR. The gap isn't technological. It's organizational will.
Which is really what this episode is about. Not just why isn't there a good first aid app, but why systems that should exist, that have every ingredient lined up, still fail to materialize. And whether the answer is to wait for institutions to act, or to build something from the ground up.
What Daniel's really surfaced is a category error in how we think about first aid training. We treat it as a qualification you earn, not a capability you maintain.
But it's not a refresher system. There's no spaced repetition, no skill assessment, no interactive practice. You wouldn't expect to retain a foreign language by taking one intensive weekend class every 24 months.
You'd use Duolingo for 10 minutes a day.
And nobody has built Duolingo for first aid. That's the gap. It's not that the information is secret or expensive or hard to teach, it's that nobody has packaged it for the way human memory actually works. That 3 to 6 month number isn't vague. A study out of the University of Washington tracked CPR skill retention in laypeople. At 3 months post-training, compression depth was already drifting.
Daniel's point about guidelines not updating frequently enough to be a technical barrier, he's right about that too. The American Heart Association updates CPR guidelines every 5 years. The model is fundamentally misaligned with how human memory works. You can't cram procedural knowledge into a weekend course and expect it to stick for years. That's not a training failure. It's a design failure.
What's needed is spaced repetition for procedural skills. We know this works for declarative knowledge, flashcards, Anki decks, language learning, but applying it to physical skills is trickier. You need some combination of knowledge refresh and physical practice, and nobody has built a system that does both at scale. Let's talk about the three reasons this doesn't exist, because they're not what most people assume. The first one is liability. Imagine you're the American Red Cross, and you release an app that uses AR to show someone where to place their hands for CPR. Someone uses it in an actual emergency, the outcome is bad, and the family sues. I found a few when I searched. One uses ARKit for wound assessment. You point your phone at an injury and it estimates severity and walks you through treatment steps. Another generates branching emergency scenarios using a large language model. But none of them are validated by a medical authority, none are maintained long-term, and none are part of a unified platform.
You'd have to cobble together four different apps, hope they're all accurate, and somehow build your own refresher schedule around them. That's not a solution. That's a hobby project with higher stakes than most hobbies.
This gets us to the validation barrier, which I think is the real bottleneck. First aid is high stakes. If your language learning app teaches you the wrong verb conjugation, you sound silly in Barcelona. If your first aid app tells you the wrong compression depth or misidentifies a stroke symptom, someone could die.
That's a pretty strong disincentive to ship something.
It's a massive chilling effect. Organizations like the Red Cross, Mogen David Adam, the American Heart Association, they're risk-averse by design. Their reputations rest on trust. If they put out an interactive AR app and it gives bad guidance in even one edge case, the liability and reputational damage could be enormous. So they stick with what's safe, static content that's been reviewed by 17 committees. If you build an effective app that lets people practice CPR on a pillow with their phone camera, providing feedback on compression depth and rate, you've just offered a free or $1 alternative to a $600 product.
The business model actively resists the innovation.
We weigh the visible risk of our app gave wrong guidance, much more heavily than the invisible risk of someone forgot how to do CPR because we never gave them a refresher tool. One is a lawsuit waiting to happen. The other is a statistical abstraction.
The person who dies because of bystander's CPR training had decayed. That death doesn't come with a label saying caused by institutional risk aversion. It just looks like a tragic outcome. The accountability is diffuse.
There's another layer here too. Medical validation isn't cheap. You need physicians reviewing content, testing edge cases, signing off on updates. For a static web page, that's manageable. Update it every few years, one review cycle. For an interactive app with AR overlays and AI-generated scenarios, the surface area for errors is much larger. Every possible interaction needs to be reviewed. The RFP doesn't say integrate LiDAR-based pose estimation for compression feedback because the organization doesn't know to ask for that, and the agency isn't going to propose something that makes the project four times more expensive and harder to deliver.
That creates a perverse incentive to build the least useful version, the static pamphlet, because it's the safest and cheapest to approve.
That's exactly what we see. The Red Cross app exists. MDA's website exists. They're safe, validated, and almost entirely passive. They check the box of providing first aid information without taking on the risk of actually helping people retain it. On-device machine learning means you can run pose estimation models locally, no cloud required, which actually helps with the liability issue because you're not transmitting sensitive health data to a server. You could build an app today that uses the front-facing camera to watch someone do chest compressions on a pillow, measure the depth based on hand displacement, count the rate, and give real-time audio feedback, a little faster. What's frustrating is that the technology side keeps getting easier. 5 years ago, building an AR overlay for CPR would have required custom computer vision models and a lot of janky calibration.
The barrier isn't technical feasibility. We're in this strange situation where the technical barrier is falling towards zero, while the organizational barrier remains exactly where it was a decade ago. The gap between what's possible and what's available keeps widening.
That widening gap is where the opportunity lives. Whether for a private company willing to navigate the liability question, or for a community-driven effort that distributes the validation burden differently. There's another dimension here that doesn't get talked about enough. This gap creates a two-tier system. If you work in a hospital, if you're a military medic, if you're married to a doctor, you get refreshers. Formal or informal, but you get them.
Or whether the liability question kills it before the market question even matters. A placebo with your name on it in nice font. There's research showing bystander CPR rates are significantly lower in communities without regular training access. Not because they don't care, but because they know they've forgotten and they're terrified of making it worse.
The people with the most access to refreshers are the ones least likely to need them outside a clinical setting. If someone spends the first 90 seconds of that window frozen, scrolling through a mental filing cabinet trying to remember what they learned 3 years ago, the outcome changes. Daniel's not unusual. He's the norm. He's the motivated person who did the course and still doesn't feel ready. Other countries have tried to address this structurally. Germany requires first aid training for anyone getting a driver's license. That creates a built-in refresh cycle. Every few years when you renew, or at minimum, once when you first apply.
Daniel asked whether organizations have sprung up to fill this, and you found a few.
A handful, none of which have scaled. There's an outfit in the UK called First Aid for All, which offers free digital resources, but it's essentially a website with guides, no app, no interactivity. Nobody has solved the living resource problem. Germany's approach addresses the everyone should get trained part, which is valuable. But it doesn't address the skills decay in 3 to 6 months part. No country has. Australia has Save a Life, a nonprofit that distributes free training kits with little inflatable mannequins, which is actually clever because it solves the haptic problem, but it's a physical product, not a digital tool, and it doesn't scale globally.
The community-driven efforts exist, but they're fragmented, underfunded, and none of them have cracked the interactive digital piece.
That brings us to the private sector question Daniel raised. Why hasn't a startup swooped in? The addressable market is theoretically everyone with a pulse. But here's the brutal economics. People expect first aid information to be free. It's classified in the public mind the same way as emergency phone numbers. You don't pay for 911. Why would you pay for the instructions on what to do while you wait?
Even though Daniel explicitly said he would pay.
The community handles updates, translations, AR asset creation. The medical board handles approval. It's a hybrid. A freemium model could work, basic CPR, and choking-free, advanced scenario packs for bleeding control, snake bites, wilderness first aid as in-app purchases. But you'd need to get to critical mass before the revenue justifies the development cost. And you'd need medical validation, which means partnering with an established organization, which brings you right back to the liability and institutional inertia problems.
It's a knot. Every path out leads back to the same stuck institutions.
You could record a CPR demonstration once, have it reviewed by a medical board, and then anyone with a phone could project that guidance onto their actual environment. It shows AED locations, it has refresher videos, and it connects trained volunteers to nearby cardiac arrests. After launch, bystander CPR rates in Denmark increased by 30%. That's not a marginal improvement, that's a transformation.
The app tracks your timing and depth using the accelerometer. It schedules your next refresher based on your performance, not a calendar.
That's the thing. The spaced repetition scheduling is a solved problem. Anki's algorithm has been around for years. You could adapt it for procedural skills easily. Pass your quarterly CPR refresher with good metrics. The app pushes your next session further out. Struggle with compression depth. It brings you back in 2 weeks. Adaptive, personalized, evidence-based. Mogan David Adam and United Hetzala do incredible response work, but the preparedness side is essentially left to the private market, which, as we've established, hasn't solved it.
Denmark proves the model works. Government funding, validated content, wide distribution, measurable outcomes. The blueprint exists.
The app would need to convert passive certificate holders into active learners, and that's a hard behavioral shift. Emergency response is one bucket, preventative health is another, digital infrastructure is a third. Nobody owns the intersection.
The org chart is the enemy of the good idea.
You'd need scale to cover the review overhead, but you can't get scale without validation, and you can't get validation without funding. Classic chicken and egg. You can point your phone camera at an object, a sign, a scene, and the system understands what it's looking at. Google has circle to search, same idea. The capability to point your phone at a bleeding wound and get step-by-step pressure and elevation instructions overlaid on the actual injury, that's technically feasible right now, not in 5 years. The computer vision models exist. It's the same reason people don't buy earthquake insurance until after the earthquake. The risk is abstract, the cost is concrete, and the status quo feels fine right up until it isn't.
Given all of that, the liability trap, the chicken and egg validation problem, the it's good enough complacency, what does a motivated person actually do right now? Because Daniel's question isn't just diagnostic, he wants something he can use.
And the honest answer is that the current best approach is a bit janky. It's a hybrid. Step 1, take an in-person course for the initial training. You need the hands-on reps with a mannequin, someone correcting your hand placement, the muscle memory. No app replaces that first exposure.
That's what Daniel and Hannah did before Ezra was born, so they've got the foundation. And still, the official response from most first aid organizations is a PDF and a video from the Obama era.
CPR compression rates, stroke symptom checklists, choking protocols for infants versus adults, burn classification. Break the protocols into flashcard-sized chunks and let the algorithm schedule your reviews. Every year that passes without a tool like this, people who took the course and meant well are standing frozen in their kitchens at 2 in the morning, phone in hand, scrolling past bullet points while the clock runs. It's not designed for this, but the underlying principle is the same. You're fighting the forgetting curve with timed re-exposure, and you can load it with the specific protocols from whatever course you took.
That's what's missing from most conversations about this.
If you can get access to a mannequin through a community group or a refresher workshop, even better. But the key is doing it on a schedule, not waiting until you feel rusty, because by the time you feel rusty, you're already well past the decay cliff. You spend maybe 15 minutes, you pull up a validated video from the American Heart Association or the Red Cross on YouTube, and you physically walk through the motions. It's the best we've got until someone builds the thing we've been describing. And I'll add, the quarterly practice doesn't have to be solo. That's actually the bridge to Daniel's community point.
Because the social component solves a real problem. If you tell yourself you'll practice CPR every 3 months, you probably won't.
And the validated video part matters. Don't just search CPR and click the first result. Use the official channels. The American Heart Association's YouTube channel has current, protocol-accurate demonstrations. The British Red Cross does too. The accountability mechanism is powerful. Start or join a local first aid refresher group. Rotate who brings the scenarios. One session you do infant choking, next session you do adult CPR, then wound packing, then stroke recognition.
It solves the confidence problem you were talking about. Even just knowing you physically practiced 3 months ago changes whether you freeze or act.
The second thing is simpler but harder for most people, demand better. If you're a parent, a teacher, a coach, email your local first aid organization. Mag and David Adam here in Israel, the Red Cross wherever you are, St. Sacy. This also builds a local network. If someone in your neighborhood has a medical emergency, you now know which of your neighbors has recent refresher practice. That's not nothing. They're membership-driven and donation-funded. When enough people ask the same question, it lands on someone's strategic planning document.
But the someone else is often just another bystander who also hasn't practiced in 2 years.
For the builders listening, the ones who hear this and think, I could build that app, the market gap is real.
The third thing is for the technically inclined listeners, and I know we have a fair number of those. Daniel's prompt mentioned AR and AI tools, and you said earlier that the core technology for an AR first aid app is basically a hackathon project with the right SDKs. How realistic is that for someone listening?
ARKit from Apple has been available since 2017. It does plane detection, motion tracking, scene understanding. Coromel lets you run pose estimation models on device. You could build a proof of concept that uses the front-facing camera to track hand position during CPR practice. Measure compression depth by calculating hand displacement relative to a detected surface, and give audio feedback. That partnership model changes the risk calculus for them. They get to say they offer an interactive refresher tool without having to develop it in-house. You get the stamp of medical authority without having to build a review board from scratch.
Here's our call to action. If you know of a project that's actually solving this, a community-maintained first aid knowledge base, an open-source AR training app, a government initiative we haven't heard about, email us.
But a proof of concept changes the conversation. If someone builds a working demo and puts it on GitHub, it becomes a thing that exists. Organizations can point to it. Researchers can study it. Because the frustrating thing about this whole conversation is that the solution is so close. Every ingredient exists. Someone just needs to combine them. And if that someone is listening right now, we want to know about it. Now the question is whether you'll endorse it, improve it, or ignore it while the world moves on.
Is it a market failure? The economics don't work for a private company. Is it a coordination failure? The pieces exist, but nobody's assembling them. Or is it a motivation failure? Not enough people care.
I think it's all three, but the bottleneck is motivation. And I don't mean individual motivation. Daniel's motivated. Millions of parents are motivated. I mean institutional motivation. The organizations that could solve this don't feel the pain of not solving it. They're not the ones standing over someone who isn't breathing, realizing they can't remember the compression rate. That's a measured outcome in a real country with real people. The blueprint is public. The technology is mature. Here's the thing that makes me optimistic despite all of this. We're probably 5 to 10 years from AR glasses being mainstream.
I think that's the thread that runs through all three of these. The skill decay calendar, the emails demanding better, the open source demo. They're all ways of saying, we're not waiting anymore. The motivated people are here. The tools are here. Which would be transformative, but it's also a decade away, and the gap today is much simpler to fix. We don't need neural interfaces or heads-up displays. We need an app with spaced repetition, and maybe some AR overlays.
That pressure is building whether the organizations feel it yet or not. That's what makes the whole thing so maddening. We're not waiting on a breakthrough, we're waiting on someone to decide it's worth doing.
Daniel, the guy who sent us this prompt is exactly the person the system should serve. He's motivated. He's willing to pay. He just wants a good tool. The fact that he can't find one isn't just inconvenient. It's an indictment of how we've chosen to organize life-saving knowledge. Or does the first mover just become the cautionary tale after a lawsuit?
And the fact that it doesn't, that a parent in Jerusalem with a smartphone and a credit card can't buy a validated first aid refresher, that tells you something about where our priorities actually land. If someone launches with a clear disclaimer framework, peer-reviewed validation studies, and maybe even a regulatory sandbox arrangement with a health ministry, they've built a moat. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping us on track.
If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who'd want to know why their first aid certificate might be a placebo. And if you're building the thing we described, or you found it, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. In 3 to 5 years, a meaningful number of people are going to have a heads-up display that can overlay instructions directly onto their field of view while their hands are free.
That's the scenario where this goes from nice to have to why on earth don't we have this? Imagine a parent with AR glasses. The child is choking. The glasses detect the emergency, or the parent triggers it with a voice command, and suddenly there's a visual overlay showing exactly where to position the infant, the angle for back blows, a countdown timer, haptic feedback on the rhythm. The technology to do that is not speculative. The computer vision, the pose tracking, the protocol rendering, it all exists. The ecosystem to validate it, certify it, and deploy it does not.
We're heading toward a moment where the capability is so obviously present that the absence of the tool becomes indefensible. And the question is whether the first aid organizations get there first, or whether Apple or Google just build it into the operating system and bypass them entirely.
That's the scenario that should be keeping someone awake at a board meeting. If the institutions don't build it, the platform companies will, and they won't ask permission. They'll ship a health emergency assistant as a feature update, train it on publicly available protocols, and disclaim liability in a 40-page terms of service nobody reads. It won't be validated by the American Heart Association, but it'll be on a billion devices by Tuesday.
At that point, the validation question becomes secondary to the distribution question. People will use what's in front of them.
Which is why the window for the established organizations to lead on this is closing. They have the medical authority now. They won't have a monopoly on distribution for much longer.
For Daniel, and for everyone listening who's been nodding along, here's where we land. If you found a good first aid refresher app or resource, something that actually works, something with visuals and interactivity and not just bullet points, email us, prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We'll compile a list for the show notes. If enough people surface things we haven't found, we'll do a follow-up.
If you're sitting there thinking, I could build a prototype of this, build it. Put it somewhere we can find it. The gap between what's possible and what's available is the widest I've seen in any domain that actually matters for human survival. That's either an indictment or an invitation, depending on what you do next.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1912, a microbiologist in Bishkek documented a strain of smoked horse milk cheese whose rind contained a bacterium that produced trace amounts of trimethylamine, the same compound responsible for the odor of rotting fish.
I have so many follow-up questions, and I'm going to suppress all of them.
That's the right instinct. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.